WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. Now, here's your host, Paul Dragoo.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. It's Wednesday, April 12th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Here are the stories we're following today. In his latest shameless display of corrupt power politicking, Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg is suing Congressman Jim Jordan in federal court. Bragg is using the lawsuit to fight back against a congressional subpoena by Jordan's House Judiciary Committee.
Chairman Jordan's subpoena is an unconstitutional attempt to undermine an ongoing New York felony criminal prosecution and investigation, Bragg said, claiming the subpoena, quote, is an unprecedented, illegitimate interference by Congress that lacks any legal merit and defies basic principles of federalism. The Manhattan DA's office focuses on the law and the evidence, not political gamesmanship or threats. In court papers, the DA contended the committee lacked the authority to conduct its own investigation, one already handled by a grand jury. Chairman Jordan and the committee have, in essence, appointed Congress as a super grand jury that can flex its subpoena power to second-guess the judgment of New York citizens and interfere with the state criminal justice process, the suit charged.
The Manhattan DA repeatedly bragged during his campaign that he would go after President Donald Trump. He's done exactly that, and he's used federal funds to do so. Now he's pretending to be outraged that Congress would dare question his motives or use of federal funds. Now that there's serious pushback from the new GOP majority in the House, Bragg's latest move shows there's nothing the left won't do to preserve its grip on power. Bragg is already working to destroy Trump and is obviously willing to unleash his legal minions on members of Congress as well. Jim Jordan, who is not easily intimidated, tweeted in response, "First they indict a president for no crime, then they sue to block congressional oversight when we ask questions about the federal funds they say they used to do it." There's no indication this has made Jordan rethink the investigation.
But Jordan is not giving up. While a court decides whether Mark Pomerantz has to testify, Jordan and his committee are heading to New York next week to put Bragg under the microscope and discuss his crime-fighting policies.
And officials in Nashville have reappointed their ousted state representative, Justin Jones, to the Tennessee House as an interim to fill his own vacant position. He walked back onto the House floor Monday, raising a fist to raucous shouts from crowds in the galleries. Jones was one of two lawmakers the Republican majority voted to expel for leading protesters in an hour-long disruption of legislative business on March 30. They used a bullhorn to repeatedly chant, "No action, no peace," demanding stricter gun control after the deadly shooting at Nashville's Covenant School on March 27. The city's Metropolitan Council overruled the decision of the Tennessee House in a unanimous vote. They did so by suspending a procedural rule that prevents someone from being nominated and appointed to an interim position during the same meeting. After that vote, Jones marched back to the state capitol amidst supporters and addressed them, this time outside, on the steps.
It was students walking out of classes and taking to this capitol that led us into the well that day, calling for common sense gun laws. And the first thing I do when I walk into this building as a representative is to continue that call for common sense gun legislation. Secondly, we are calling on House Speaker Cameron Sexton to resign as Speaker of the House. He is an enemy of democracy and the people have spoken. And so we will continue to speak up and resist and show up because this is the rebirth, the resurrection of a movement in Tennessee that's going to keep going, not just today, but in the days ahead. We will continue to show up and birth a new South, because right here in Nashville, we've had movements before led by young people that transformed this nation, and it's our time again.
His colleague, Justin Pearson of Memphis, is expected to be reinstated today by his constituency, also to fill the position on an interim basis. Both men have said they plan to run in the special elections for their seats. They got a boost last week with a surprise visit from U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, who spoke on their behalf Friday at Fisk University. During her visit, she met with the entire Democratic Tennessee State Caucus, as well as the ousted representatives. But She didn't take time for the families of the school shooting victims, which sparked harsh criticism from liberals and conservatives. Others pointed out the inequity of treatment that J6ers have received compared to the coddling of the Tennessee House disruptors. All this adds fuel to the new hashtag, Release the Manifesto, which is spreading through social media like wildfire. It refers to the written declaration that the Covenant school shooter left behind. The Metro Nashville police chief said it revealed possible insights into the killer's motive. But now that the Tennessee Bureau of Investigations has the document, the story is changing. Here's Bureau Director David Rausch.
It's been characterized as a manifesto. I think that's a mischaracterization, personally. The documents that we have, and I have viewed those, one is specifically a plan, and the other is some journal type rantings, but nothing, when you talk about manifesto, you talk about something similar to like the Unabomber left behind, ideological expressions, that none of that has surfaced in these writings. It's really unfortunate mental health issues that you can see as you read through the journal.
Whatever you want to call it, a new Rasmussen Reports poll says 68% of American voters want to see it. And meanwhile, Tennessee's Republican Governor Bill Lee signed an executive order yesterday that tightened state background checks for buying firearms. His order mandates that government officials report all criminal and court mental health information to the state instant background check system within 72 hours. He's also called on the state legislature to pass a red flag law, making it easier to confiscate guns from people who are considered dangerous. It's a surprising turnaround for the conservative. 2 years ago, he led the charge in the state to allow residents 21 and older to carry handguns in public without a permit. Critics say he's given in to pressure following the Covenant school shooting. Lawmakers like Knoxville Representative Jason Zachary are vowing to oppose any red flag attempts, calling them bad policy for depriving individuals of due process. Tennessee already has laws preventing mentally ill people from having guns. And here's some shocking news. Documents acquired by America First Legal Foundation suggest that the Biden White House was involved in the FBI raid on Trump's Mar-a-Lago home on August 8th of last year. America First Legal senior counselor and director of oversight and investigations, Reid Rubenstein, said in a social media post on Tuesday, "The evidence further suggests that Biden officials in the executive office of the president and the Department of Justice unlawfully abused their power and then lied about it to the American people." The Freedom of Information request revealed that the FBI first got access to Trump records through a special access request from the Biden White House. In the immediate aftermath of the incident, the White House press secretary said Joe Biden and other White House officials found out about the raid from news reports, just like you and me. Could it be they were lying? Join me to discuss today's stories is my esteemed colleague, executive senior editor of The New American, Steve Bonta. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Paul.
So I am shocked, Steve. I am shocked that the White House would actually cooperate to let out information that would implicate them in the raid. I think that's what's most shocking about this.
That they would actually let something slip.
Yeah. Have you thought about that?
Not really. I mean, I was commenting this morning following the news these days is trying to drink water from a fire hose. Mm-hmm. There's just so much stuff. I mean, the keeper headline is organized evil still up to no good.
Right.
But occasionally even organized evil doesn't
it's
get
not organized
right.
enough, huh?
It's not. No, it never can be organized enough, I guess, from their point of view. But I don't really know what to say about the Mar-a-Lago thing, except that it's been patently obvious from the beginning that the
right.
White House and the Department of Justice and everybody was behind this, that's plan B or plan C should the nefarious schemes of Al Bragg run afoul, come up against something like, a Supreme Court ruling or an appeals ruling. There's little doubt in my mind, frankly, that Trump will be convicted because it's clear that, the judge that's presiding over the case is not going to grant a change of venue since he's a big-time Biden supporter and Biden donor. Okay, so he wants to make sure, and we can just assume that he'll be as rabidly partisan as the rest of them. That seems to be the default setting, unfortunately, for most powerful Democrats today. So he's not going to do the principled thing and allow a change of venue to, say, Staten Island or upstate New York for the Trump trial, which means Trump is going to be convicted, by a jury of rabid anti-Trump Democrats. You know, the fix is completely in. And so his only hope would be finding, relief in some sort of in the appeals process, my opinion. You could already see where this is going.
Yeah.
It's foreordained. But should there be some unforeseen slip-up, well, there's always the Georgia witch hunt and, of course, the Florida Mar-a-Lago thing waiting in the wings, and they will be rolled out in due course.
Yeah, as we've said over and over, it's clear they are determined to stop this man from running or even winning the presidency. What are your thoughts on the Jim Jordan or the lawsuit against Jim Jordan? You picked up the story yesterday. What do you think about it?
What do I think? Well, again, it's fairly obvious what the motives are here. So here we have, let's just reframe the story. We have a guy, the incredibly aptly named Al Bragg, boasting about how he's going to take Trump down while he's running for an office that presumably requires him to be, blind and impartial.
Yeah.
As Lady Justice was once reputed to be. So he's clearly, nothing more than a tawdry politician dressed in DA attire.
Correct.
Okay,
yeah.
So there's no surprise there. He uses federal funds to prosecute a case for which the statute of limitations is long expired, which is, if anything, a federal violation, a violation of federal law, over which he has no jurisdiction, which he's trying to torture into something that he does have jurisdiction over, which is a misdemeanor, which he's trying to turn into a felony, which allegedly had to do with the 2016 elections, but yet for which most of the allegedly nefarious activities were carried out in 2017. So it's completely absurd on the face of it. And now this man has the unmitigated gall
no kidding.
To tell Congress it has no right to even ask questions about his alleged misuse of federal funds in this. So this is a guy who is, calling him shameless gives the likes of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama a bad name, frankly.
Right.
It really takes shamelessness to a whole new level.
I was watching that, and you could hear his, like you said, I was like, how dare you? And he talks about democracy and things like that. And I wonder, does this guy actually believe that what he's doing is right? Because we know that exists. Obviously, we all have these biases and these filters through which we look at things. And you just got to wonder, it's like, we also saw Justin, is it Jones, the one who walked in there. And, and they're talking about these crusades, which are the opposite. They seem to be the mirror opposite of what they say they're fighting for. Isn't that crazy?
Well, here's the thing. People, despite what the trans activists would have us believe, there are things about our nature, our God-given nature, that we cannot change. And one of those things is that we will ally ourselves to some cause which will sort of become the moral and ethical framing for what we for our actions, and we will defend that cause. Okay? So if our moral compass gets out of whack, then we will perhaps we tend to embrace causes that are anti-moral, amoral, but we'll still defend them with the same fervor and clarity of purpose that an old-fashioned crusader or anybody
on an honorable mission.
Well, I'm not sure that the Crusades are necessarily all honorable, but people used to reserve for religion and perhaps legitimate political passions, are now. So those same passions are always going to exist, but now by a certain group of people are being channeled into these absolutely morally inane causes.
Yeah.
Just incredibly deleterious to the body politic, but they believe in them. So the people who are advocating on behalf of the right to, to groom little children and to try to encourage them to switch genders and all this stuff. It's just absolutely unmitigated evil.
Yeah.
They want to destroy the innocence of childhood. But they're pursuing it with that same that same sort of fixity of purpose that you used to see in, oh, I don't know, the Puritans or something like that.
Yeah.
It's the same type of zeal.
It's like the
Bible. So I have no doubt that he believes.
And you think so?
Long answer, short question. I have no doubt that he believes absolutely and conceitedly in his own righteousness.
Yeah.
They all do. Yeah. I think that, you know, the left is certainly sincere in that regard. But in that conceit, they also believe that the end absolutely justifies the means because they perceive anyone who opposes them as being evil.
Right.
And as long ago as observed, that's the difference between us and them, is that we, in our naivete, tend to regard them as misguided.
They're not.
Well, and but they regard us as evil, and there's a difference.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's why it's like when journalists justify being biased and censoring and things like that. They think that they're censoring and saving democracy. And
absolutely.
There's
really no such thing as a cartoon villain who laughs at his evil plan. Yeah. I mean, the real life villain, deviltry and villainy is always, almost always, is done for the greater good.
Yep.
Even the Hitlers and the Stalins, in some twisted way, thought they were doing good.
Thanks, Steve. Stay tuned, because after this quick break, we're going to discuss one of the latest flag words the FBI is using to identify domestic terrorists, as well as upcoming changes that car manufacturers are implementing that would limit access to conservative talk radio. We'll be right back.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution.
What we need are just more people that would read the one we have.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
Who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand when necessary.
Welcome back. Let's take a look at the rest of our stories. Have you been red-pilled or suggested that someone is red-pilled? If so, you better watch out, because the FBI may think you're a violent extremist. The term red pill comes from the 1999 hit movie, The Matrix. In the movie, Morpheus offers the hero, Neo, a choice between two pills. Take the blue, and he wakes up and believes what he wants. Take the red pill, and he's shown how deep the rabbit hole goes.
You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Since the movie, being red pill has become part of the cultural and political lexicon. It has come to refer to people who recognize the serious threat against individual liberty and the conspiracy for a one-world totalitarian government. However, the FBI offers a different definition. In its glossary of terms used by racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists, the FBI says that taking the red pill or becoming red pill indicates the adoption of racist, anti-Semitic, and fascist beliefs. This, of course, only reinforces what red pill Americans believe. And in the name of safety, some car manufacturers are getting rid of AM radios from their latest electric and gas-powered models. The excuse is that AM is a source of radio frequency emissions that interfere with autopilot functions on cars. Some say the change makes for better road safety. Others, however, suspect a censorship goal, since AM is a common medium for conservative radio. The issue first came to light in late 2020, and Ford Motor Company is the latest to ditch AM. Citing safety concerns, Ford announced last week that it's transitioning away from AM radio in most new and updated models beginning in 2024. Company spokesman Wes Sherwood told the Detroit Free Press that Ford's commercial vehicles will continue to offer AM radio because of long-standing contract language. He offered no explanation as to why safety considerations would not trump old contracts. But is AM radio so expendable? Here's what some champions of the medium have to say.
Car makers are dropping AM radio for many new electric vehicles because interference causes annoying static that makes the signal almost unlistenable. Now, Oregon Senator Ed Markey is calling on automakers to leave the dial alone. In a new letter to 20 manufacturers, he calls AM radio a crucial communication tool for the government during emergencies. And AM radio stations are panicking as well, worrying that their voices will soon be silenced for good. And to talk more about this, we're going to bring in Brian Winnikins, the owner of WRDN in Durand, Wisconsin, to talk about the significance of AM radio. Brian, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me.
I hate the form of this question, but I'm not sure how else to ask it. Can you? It's like I'm asking you to justify your existence, but for a society where many people have forgotten about AM radio, what purpose does it serve? How important is it?
For farmers, 76% of farmers still use AM, FM, free, over-the-air radio to get their daily farm news and market information. Also, there's the community service of it. We do high school sports. Many AM radio stations do high school sports, local news, community events. Again, like for us, I'm not sure if News Nation is going to be covering the Durand, Arkansas monthly school board meeting or the Pepin County board meeting or things like that. And you shouldn't. That's our job as local free over-the-air AM and FM broadcasters. And so AM is still important. And AM goes a lot farther than an FM signal does.
As that commentator said, it's not just conservatives who are concerned about axing AM. Massachusetts Democrat Senator Ed Markey is pushing back as well. He sent a letter in December to automakers urging them to keep AM radio in cars for the sake of public safety. Last month, he released responses from top manufacturers. Eight of them have already removed AM radio from their products. BMW, Ford, Mazda, Tesla, Volkswagen, and Volvo are among these. 10 others still maintain AM radio, including Honda, Hyundai, Nissan, Subaru, and Toyota. Why it is a safety hazard in some and not in others remains a mystery. Markey said many automakers suggested other communication tools such as internet radio, but he pointed out that in an emergency, AM is often the only option. He called it irreplaceable. The Federal Emergency Management Agency's National Public Warning System relies on it, and Markey's urging vehicle manufacturers to invest in updated technology that will not be debilitated by AM signals. What do you think, Steve?
Well, of course, the thing that the news clip didn't mention was the elephant in the room, and that is that AM radio is the primary vehicle for talk radio. And talk radio is overwhelmingly, except for NPR, which is typically on FM radio. Mm-hmm. So we'll leave that one alone, of course.
Yeah.
But all the big talk radio shows, I mean, Rush Limbaugh back in the late 80s was credited with almost single-handedly rescuing AM radio from oblivion because people already, even in those days, were, you know, many of the best music was on FM. And so people didn't see any reason to listen to AM radio. And then talk radio came along and completely single-handedly rejuvenated. Yeah, I mean, sure. Listening to farm reports and so forth, that's important too in a certain part of the United States. But talk radio was the thing that really gave AM radio a second life. Of course, this must all be coincidental.
Right?
I can't imagine that big auto companies would be under any subtle
pressure
to remove that, you know. I mean, because most people who listen to talk radio do it while they're driving.
Right.
So if you take that out of their lives, my goodness, people can no longer be brainwashed into believing all these wild, extreme, into being red-pilled,
right,
so to speak.
There you go. I mean, when I worked in the shop when I was turning wrenches, I did so for about 10 years, a lot of the mechanics, when they listen to talk radio, and I'd say about half of them listen to talk radio, others, you know, rock and whatever, is they listen to AM, of course, and they listen to conservative talk shows because that's kind of all that seemed to have been available. You know, in Atlanta, Neil Bortz was huge, and then Sean Hannity came on and so forth. I mean, obviously it's suspicious, and like we had mentioned, how come these other car manufacturers haven't discovered this safety hazard because of AM? It's crazy. Do you think you're being followed now? You're an extremist? Because you're red-pilled?
Perhaps, and I should mention that red pill was only one of the terms. There are a whole bunch of other terms that were on that FBI list. So it included, if Greg Gutfeld is any authority on this, and he was talking about this last night in his usual inimitable comedic fashion, but apparently the word Chad, which I'm given to understand is in the gibberish that passes for language spoken by Gen Z, mm-hmm. refers to any masculine, what we used to call a jock or something like that. So that's what that means. So for some reason, Chad is now considered dangerous. So you hear that? Chad, if you're listening into the show. Okay? So we just use Chad. Also verboten, let's see. Based, I think. And my understanding of based is There was a guy they referred to as Based Stickman, who was kind of an extreme right-wing guy that was involved in some of the demonstrations against Antifa or BLM or whatever a few years ago. But Based, I think, is a more general term. It means a person who is very grounded or who knows the score. It's not necessarily associated with the dreaded right-wingers. And it goes on and on and on.
Right. Okay. Well, that's I was at one of the Red Pill Expos a couple of years back, and I got to tell you, man.
Mingling with the FBI informants, no
right.
doubt.
Well, maybe, who knows? But you look at those people, it's like those people are probably some of them are not even capable of being extremists. Obviously, the founder is G. Edward Griffin, a longtime Bircher and whatnot. You know, Ed's like 90 years old. He started the Red Pill Expo. So it's interesting to see. It's like at some point you got to wonder, they have so many terms. I've seen this list and it's long. Hmm. It's like, how do they keep up with it? And what happens if we all just started throwing red pill around? That's a really commonly used term. We use it, I think, in a way to refer to people who understand that there's this conspiracy for a one world government.
Well, I think in terms of the methodology, it really, really, really reminds me of communist China, because that's how they police their internet and, by extension, their people. So they're constantly on the lookout for new terms that can connote something that might be in opposition to the regime or whatever. They flag that term, and then they literally go around. They have millions of people who are employed by the government to follow WeChat posts and all this other stuff. And they go out and they delete these posts. So then the Chinese, if there's some issue that they really want to get out there, they'll invent code words. And then as soon as the government finds out
the code,
so for example, if you use Winnie the Pooh or any references to Winnie the Pooh, which of course is a bit of a derogative from Xi, they'll delete that. So it's very reminiscent of how the communist Chinese operate.
That's terrible. That's so sad that we're here. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
Well, that's all for our news segment today. For more truth behind the news, make sure to get a subscription to the New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com or by calling our office at 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. That's 800-727-8783. And stay tuned, because after this, we're going to show an interview Alex Newman conducted with an expert on human trafficking, as well as a recent Constitution Corner lesson from Robert Owens on why America must return to non-interventionist foreign policy.
Imprisonment. Forced labor, permanent separation from my family, perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect, but the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped through my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home. But I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo. A thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase Defector at shopjbs.org.
Some topics, such as the Trump indictment, are all over the news. Other topics, such as human trafficking, do not receive the coverage they deserve. Next up, the New American's Alex Newman interviews an expert on this crucial subject.
Welcome to Conversations That Matter. I'm your host, Alex Newman, here for the New American Magazine. Thank you for joining us today. We have a very special guest. Her name is Becky Rasmussen. She is the CEO and founder of a ministry dealing with human trafficking, trying to stop it, trying to combat it, trying to help the victims. It's called Call to Freedom. You can find them at calltofreedom.org. She's also a supporting author to a book called A Parent's Guide to Understanding Human Trafficking and Healing Their Children. Becky, thank you for joining us. It's an honor to have you on the program. This is obviously a very difficult subject, but talk to us about human trafficking. Is this a huge problem in the United States? What do people need to know about what's happening?
Yeah. So if you're not familiar with human trafficking, I think a lot of people have misconceptions of what human trafficking looks like today. There's been movies like Taken, and it can happen that way. But we see today more of that, what we call manipulation or grooming of the victims. And so if you're not familiar with human trafficking, it's the use of force, fraud, or coercion to exploit an individual for either sex or labor. And so if either of those two elements are present, we're talking about human trafficking, if force, fraud, or coercion, unless you're under the age of 18. And so what we've seen is we began in 2016 providing services to those that are impacted by human trafficking and commercial sexual exploitation. And I never knew the need would be as great as what we're seeing. Even in South Dakota, when we have three of the poorest counties in the United States located here, we're getting calls from all over the United States because of the lack of services that are available to victims of human trafficking. And if those that are impacted by trafficking do not have the support or services, they typically don't leave those situations. And so there's a staggering stat that 1-3% of victims ever leave their circumstances because it's not as easy to run to a law enforcement or an agency that you believe that you can be safe at. Trafficking rings control people in many different ways. They control them by keeping their children. They control them by their personal identification, their basic needs. And they build a relationship with that victim in order to keep them controlled into those situations. And so getting out of human trafficking for victims is so much harder than people understand.
So how serious, how big of a problem is this, Becky? I mean, is this happening all across America? I obviously, it's a hard thing to track the numbers on, but what kind of numbers are we talking about here?
Yeah, I don't think we've even scratched the surface of the amount of people that are in human trafficking situations. There's so much education that needs to be happening within our first responders to better identify victims. One of the things, as you read our book, you begin to identify that people don't self-identify in these situations a lot of times. Sometimes they feel because that person has built a relationship with them that they don't even know they're a victim of human trafficking. And so it's really up to us as service providers to get better educated on that. You know, we're talking about sex and labor trafficking. I think a lot of circles talk a lot about the sex trafficking piece because that's what we're familiar with. Labor trafficking is one of the most unidentified forms of trafficking in the United States. And most people, when a labor trafficking situation comes about, they don't even know how to navigate it because it's so new. Human trafficking was first put into federal statute in early 2000. And so we have a lot of work to do as communities to better identify and to respond to the needs of human trafficking victims.
So by labor trafficking, I mean, you're kind of talking just about slavery, huh? People who are being bought and sold as workers, as people to just do various types of work.
So a lot of it is that manipulation piece. So an example of that is a foreign national population. As we have open borders and people are coming across our borders, we have a variety of different issues that are happening. So an example of labor trafficking is a promise to come to the United States for a better life, to support your family. And when they get here on these temporary visas, it's not what they expected. A lot of times you're seeing modeling agencies saying, hey, I'm going to offer you a great opportunity. I'm going to bring you down to, you know, model, and they get down to those areas and it's not what they have been promised. And so labor trafficking is facilitated through a lot of different ways.
So labor trafficking and sex trafficking, of course, a lot of that is coming across the open borders right now, as you pointed out. To what extent is the federal and maybe even state governments dealing with this appropriately or even complicit? I've heard a lot of people suggest that, you know, the Department of Health and Human Services knowingly releasing children to people who, you know, they ought to know better or not really family, that there's a problem there. You know, you hear a lot of people talk about children being grabbed by CPS and then they end up missing. And then, you know, later they turn up in sex slavery somewhere. To what extent is the government involved here? To what extent is the government combating this appropriately? What should they be doing?
I think I'm going to go back to you tend to go away from what you don't recognize or know. I think that this is, I see in a lot of those circles, we're very reactive, we're not proactive. And so until they begin to identify this as a large issue, we're finding a lot of systems just in general don't understand. And so they're not identifying. And so I think we as a government, we need to have specialized task force. We need to realize that vulnerabilities, there's a lot of intersectionalities between drugs, guns, and human trafficking. These circles know how to make money. This is organized crime. And so if we're not being proactive in cases as far as investigations and equipping law enforcement to be able to do that and do that well, we're not identifying these cases, nor are we prosecuting them. And so I think from a government standpoint, there's a lot going on with drugs. There's a lot going on with cartels. There's a lot going on with guns as well. And so I think we need to understand that those are all cross. Those are intersectionalities of these organized fronts are doing all of those together. So asking the right questions to better identify trafficking situations versus just taking a drug charge and saying, I got a possession or distribution charge on this person. And a lot of times there's forced criminality. So we've had multiple victims, a lot of victims who have been used to force criminality to sell drugs, to do guns, to do the runs for these organized fronts. And we're not identifying them in our system as successfully as we can. So I think there's a lot of work that we need to do on all system fronts to be able to combat human trafficking.
Huh, that's fascinating. So you're talking about like people who've been trafficked who are then being forced to go out and sell drugs, and they get picked up by the police. They take a charge for distribution of drugs, not even without the system even realizing that these are actually trafficking victims who've been coerced into doing these types of things, huh?
Absolutely. I think they're not going to talk. They're not going to talk because sometimes they have their children. They have things behind the scenes. They're threatening their life. We're seeing money laundering happening where young women with children have their opening LLCs and money laundering is happening. Guns, drugs, distribution. Those people who are facilitating these organized fronts from the background are not getting identified, and they're using these vulnerable individuals for not only human trafficking, but other illegal activity in order to make money off of them. So it could be sex, it could be that labor piece, it could be forced criminality. And we, again, I'm gonna go back, and that's why we wrote the book and released the book, is because people are not understanding how these organized fronts are doing this. And so we need to get smarter, and we need to be able to identify how this is happening so that we can help those that are victimized by this.
All right, folks, so we're going to go to break. When we get right back here, we'll have another segment with Becky Rasmussen talking about how victims can be supported, what kind of services they may need, and also how she got involved with this. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
If Americans want to remain a free and sovereign nation, more people need to understand the principles and values that built this great nation. At the John Birch Society, we have the organization, the plan, and the resources to do just that. Our founder, Robert Welch, said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Go to jbs.org to learn more, including how you can get involved to work locally and impact nationally. Join the John Birch Society today.
Welcome back to Conversations That Matter. Alex Newman here. Our guest today is Becky Rasmussen. She is the founder of Call to Freedom and also the CEO, and she is a supporting author on the book, A Parent's Guide to Understanding Human Trafficking and Healing Their Children. Becky, let's talk about kind of the things that you guys do through your ministry. You support victims who are coming out of this. What do these people need? How do you guys help them? What do you do for them?
Yeah, Call to Freedom was developed, and today we have 26 staff that are doing this work, and we've hired that quickly since 2016 and found funding to do that because the needs of a trafficking survivor are so great. There are so many ways that they're held into trafficking situations. So Call to Freedom is a really holistic approach to serving trafficking victims through trauma-informed comprehensive services. And so we do wraparound. We'll do that emergency piece where somebody calls and there might be an emergency department and they identify and they're in a need an assessment for mental health or addiction, because a lot of times traffickers will control their victims with a variety of different ways, and that's drugs. Most girls that we've met were not drug addicts before they met their perpetrator. And so so we have to do assessments on the mental health piece because of the complex trauma, but also that addiction piece is always very common as well with those that we serve. We've put that all on staff. One of the things that we want to do is really surround that person so that they can really focus on their ability to heal. And you get overwhelmed by the systems. If I have to look for housing or a job, or if I have to deal with my mental health or find funding for that, a lot of times that's why victims don't leave, is because they're not supported in those processes to successfully leave that controlled environment by their trafficker. And so Call to Freedom does a lot of different services from that emergency point. And then we also have supportive housing where we house mothers with their children, survivors with their children. And that houses 12 individuals and their children. And so right now we have 12 survivors. We are full with 10 children living with us, and that is a free service. And that's more of a supported living once we get through that emergency piece. And then we have one young lady who lives with us who did not have her green card. And so she couldn't work. Traffickers were actually perpetrating her because of her vulnerability of not being able to get an apartment because she didn't have her green card. And so we've supported her for the last 2 years. She just got her green card and she's working full time now and able to transition in. And then we also have education and prevention. We have navigators on staff that do that prevention and education piece to parents, to schools. And we also have youth. We serve not only adults, males, but also youth as well. And we have housing. You know, sometimes our housing isn't the right fit for an individual. And so that housing piece, we make sure that they are continually supported throughout their entire process. Bottom line is we don't put a time frame that somebody can work with us. And so if they decide that I don't have family and that's how I've been controlled, they can work with us as long as they are following through on some of the things that we ask them to do and they become self-sufficient. We will support them as long as they need that. And that is really the key to being successful with survivors, is that they know that they are fully supported in all of those aspects so they can successfully find safety, basic needs, and that support so they can be self-sufficient.
Fascinating. And now you helped with a book. This was written mostly, I guess, by Ruth Atkins, a grandmother and an actual survivor of human trafficking with a cartel. It's called The Parent's Guide to Understanding Human Trafficking and Healing Their Children. So let's dig into that in the last few minutes we have left. What do parents need to know about protecting their children from this? I mean, is this a serious risk that parents need to be thinking about? And what do they do to make sure their children don't inadvertently end up falling into this kind of thing?
Yeah. So one of the things I'd like to talk about is this is a business. So the demand creates the need for the trafficker in business. What does that mean? If the demand who's buying individuals wants a blue-eyed, blonde-haired girl that does not have addiction, is middle class, because that's what that buyer wants, that trafficker, who the business person is going to target whatever he can make a lot of money off of. So there is not one demographic for a victim of human trafficking. It really is how much money. The latest we have seen is boys, young boys. We don't talk about boys. There aren't very many services for boys. And so now we've seen this sextortion begin to happen online. And it's very rampant right now. And so we have become very passionate about getting this book into the hands of as many people as possible to educate them. I don't want to create fear for people. What we want to do is allow people to get educated on this so they can find out, how do I best protect my children in these situations? And so I would highly recommend getting the book. It was written by a grandmother of our first survivor who walked through the doors of Call to Freedom. And they didn't even know what trafficking was, but she was part of a federal case. And they found Call to Freedom. We began navigating with that. young lady, but also their family, because trauma happens to the entire unit. It's just not the individual, it is also the family. And it was also written by Mary, who is a survivor of cartel trafficking, and bringing these perspectives together to give you a holistic look at how does this work and why is my child getting drawn to some stranger by love bombing or by gaslighting and these techniques that traffickers use to understand, A, how do they recruit and groom your individuals, but then how do you protect from online perpetration or from within schools or within peer groups. The traffickers aren't just one trafficker. They work as a group. They will find what your vulnerability is, and they will make sure to exploit that vulnerability or meet that vulnerability with an individual. So that could be a grandmother. That could be a boyfriend. That could be a father figure that this person didn't have. Whatever that is, they will play this game to target your child and to draw them close to them so that they eventually leave and get pulled into trafficking situations. So there are a lot of education pieces to this. Get the book. You can go to caldofreedom.org to get the book. And then we also do have under events, other opportunities that you can get online training on social media. What does human trafficking look like? And if you are a parent navigating a potential human trafficking situation, our third session of the Parent Connections is with the survivors and how best to do that. And so they walk alongside these parents to make sure that we intervene successfully.
Wow. So some of these traffickers are grooming the kids online through social media. Some of them are grooming them at school and trying to get them to leave their parents and go with the traffickers, huh?
Yeah. So it isn't like they kidnap you, and they can do it that way, but they've gotten a lot smarter. They actually draw that person to them. They become the answer of that vulnerability within their life. And then once they draw them to themselves, it's easier to keep a person who seemed willing. And then they convince them that you made the choice to come to me. You're choosing this. Now you owe me. Those are all tactics that traffickers use. And so I just highly just encourage parents to not live in fear of this, but to get educated on how this operates so that you're well-informed and the best to protect your children.
Yeah. Yeah. So important in today's strange world. Becky, before we let you go, how'd you get involved in all this? So why did you, of all the things you could have been doing, why did you decide to start this organization and serve these victims?
I had an encounter. I always knew in my heart I was supposed to serve people. I didn't know what that looked like. I just waited on the Lord to kind of unfold that in my life. And I had an encounter with a young girl named Marissa in August of 2015 at Sturgis Rally, which is in South Dakota, and is the largest bike rally in the United States, maybe one of the few. Anywhere from 400 to 500,000 people come to that bike rally over a course of 10 days. And we were doing outreach. I'd just gotten involved with a local organization, and I just identified this girl and I felt very drawn to her. I felt like I was supposed to go talk to her. And so I did. It was about a 10-minute conversation. And I knew this girl was very scared. She wouldn't disclose what was going on. And her last words to me were, "You have no idea what kind of day I've had. You have no idea." And she was gone. Through research and an organization that was doing recovery of children at the Sturgis Rally, she was in a book of 117 girls that were missing on the missing list. And I don't have time to go to all the details, but long story short, I began to say, how does a girl potentially be in trafficking situations or go missing? And they began to tell me that there were only 298 beds in the United States for victims of human trafficking, and that they were getting re-recruited because services weren't there to support that those individuals out of the life of human trafficking or commercial exploitation. And so I felt God prompt me to be a part of the solution, be the answer to a problem that needed to be addressed. And so I filed for a 501c3 in November of 2015. In January of 2016, we got accepted. We opened our first office in March. And survivors started coming forward. They found us. They had been looking for somebody to provide services or help to them. And today, our number one referral source are other survivors. They're very smart. If you cannot meet basic needs or safety, survivors will opt not to leave those situations because it's worse for them or their loved ones in the long run if we don't do it well. And they're very smart in that regard. And so that's how Call to Freedom was started. And today we're about a $3 million agency and 26 staff. We just hired another one and we have three openings. So we'll be at 30 by the end of the year. And we have a new home that supports survivors and that was paid in full by the community. And so God has always been a part of this organization. It is his organization and he will lead it. And we have a very great group of employees who are very passionate about this in making sure that everybody has an opportunity for hope.
That's wonderful. Becky, I want to thank you so much for doing all that you're doing. Thank you for joining us today and sharing a little bit with our audience. We appreciate it very much. And hopefully we'll get you back with some more updates at some point. Thanks again.
Thank you, Alex, for having us.
All righty, folks. That was Becky Rasmussen, calltofreedom.org. You can find them online. It's calltofreedom.org. And also the book is A Parent's Guide to Understanding Human Trafficking and Healing Their Children. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'm Alex Newman. This is Conversations That Matter for the New American Magazine. Until next time, God bless you all.
Hi, I'm Alan Keyes. I'm the host of IMTV's daily talk show about news and events in America. And I want to say a good word for the New American Magazine. Not only because Alex Newman has joined us as somebody who is periodically hosting a show, but because New American Magazine represents an alternative media that is willing to tell people the truth. With so much fake news spreading about, and the fact that right now this country's in an existential crisis, we remember who we are and where we come from and what our principles are, or we die. Reading New American Magazine can keep you up to the minute on the issues that are challenging us as a people and on which that survival hangs. You can check it out and subscribe at www.thenewamerican.com.
And in our final segment, Constitution Corner host Robert Owens makes the case for once again adhering to the non-interventionist policy of the Founding Fathers in foreign affairs. And he applies that understanding to what is happening today. Let's watch.
The Founding Fathers knew far too well what would happen if one person or one entity could formally declare war as well as control the military. That is why they were careful to prohibit that in our Constitution. How has our nation gone astray of those principles and what should be done about it? We will answer those questions in a moment. But first, if you appreciate this content, please like and share this video and subscribe to our channel. This simple effort triggers the search algorithms and thus broadens the reach of this message. Article 1 of the Constitution exclusively deals with the powers of Congress. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 states that only Congress has these powers: to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water. Article 2 of the Constitution exclusively deals with the powers of the executive branch. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1 gives the president power over the military once war has been declared. The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of militia of the several states. The key goal of this concept would be that foreign policy would not be one of imperial overseas domination, but rather one of diplomacy and goodwill. On the 4th of July, 1821, John Quincy Adams clearly provided the philosophical basis of what foreign policy should be in a constitutional republic. Here's some of the highlights from this great speech. America has, in the lapse of nearly half a century, without a single exception, respected the independence of other nations while asserting and maintaining her own. She has abstained from interference in the concerns of others, even when conflict has been for principles to which she clings as to the last vital drop that visits the heart. But she goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wishers to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. America's glory is not dominion, but liberty. Her march is the march of the mind. She has a spear and a shield, but the motto upon her shield is freedom, independence, peace. This has been her declaration. This has been, as far as her necessary intercourse with the rest of mankind would permit, her practice. Men like James Madison had fought a war of independence against a tyrannical king and a lapdog parliament, and they were not going to allow anything like that to happen again. And they understood that the power of the military and standing armies could destroy the new nation. Even more radical thinkers like Thomas Jefferson argued standing armies are inconsistent with the people's freedom and completely adverse to the spirit of this country. Madison argued that the war powers issue could be solved by splitting up the power to start war from the power to wage war. But current American foreign policy has been completely lawless and with dire consequences. Consider this argument offered by former Congressman Ron Paul just this past week. He said, "Last week we saw a sharp increase in attacks on U.S. troops occupying northeastern Syria, with a drone strike against a U.S. base blamed on pro-Iran forces and a U.S. counterstrike said to have killed at least 19 people. After the U.S. retaliation, another strike by pro-Iran forces hit a number of U.S. sites in Syria. It may be just a matter of time before there are more strikes against the 900 U.S. troops based in Syria against Syria's wishes. One U.S. contractor was killed last time. Next time, it could be many more Americans." He questions, "What's behind the sudden escalation?" And then gives several examples as to where America has clearly stuck their nose where it doesn't belong. Ron Paul ended with this: "The end of the U.S. occupation of the Middle East is upon us, and the sooner we realize that, the better. We have no business meddling in their politics, occupying their territory, and stealing their resources. Americans join the U.S. military to defend the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, yet they have been manipulated by corrupt DC officials into occupying foreign lands and stealing their oil. The globalist establishment elite have full control over Joe Biden. The man is nothing more than a puppet. The elite have perverted law to the point that they can use their control over Biden to make the U.S. military their personal attack dog. As soon as a sufficient number of American people realize that the Constitution has been perverted to the point that the U.S. military is a play toy for the globalist elite, we will have a chance at real reform and a return to liberty. The best bet to make that happen is to support the success and mission of the John Birch Society. Don't just know the Constitution, live it."
Thank you for joining us today. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. And we will see you tomorrow.